People present during the autopsy, including the local lawmen, the undertaker, and Mathis, the Big Hill Trading Company owner, it seemed impossible to say who the culprit was. To separate the facts from the hearsay contained in the Bureau's case files, White settled upon a simple but elegant approach. He would methodically try to corroborate each suspect's alibi. As Sherlock Holmes famously said, when you have eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. White relied upon Agent Berger to guide him through the murk of the previous federal investigation. Agent Berger had worked on the case for a year and a half, and during that time he had pursued many of the same leads as the private eyes hired by Hale and Mathis and Molly's family. By drawing on Agent Berger's findings, White was able to quickly rule out many of the suspects, including Anna's ex-husband, Oda Brown. His alibi, that he was with another woman, checked out, and it became clear that the forger who had implicated Brown had fabricated his story, hoping to bargain with prosecutors for better prison conditions. Further investigation eliminated other suspects, like the ruffian oil workers who had been pinpointed by Harv Frias, the ousted sheriff. White then explored the rumor that Rose Osage had killed Anna because Anna had tried to seduce her boyfriend, Joe Allen. Rose and Joe had since married. White learned of the statement that Private Investigator Number 28 had obtained from the Kaw Indian woman, in which Rose had confessed to being the murderer. In a field report, an agent from the Bureau observed, "It is a matter of common knowledge that Rose was of a violent and jealous disposition." The Fairfax Town Marshal also shared with agents a disturbing detail. Around the time of Anna's murder, he had found a dark stain on the back seat of Rose's car. It looked like blood, he said. Agent Berger informed White that he had once brought Rose, Osage, and Joe to the sheriff's office for questioning. The two suspects were placed in separate rooms and left to stir. When Agent Berger interrogated Rose, she insisted that she'd nothing to do with Anna's killing. "I never had a quarrel or fight with Anna," she stated. Agent Berger then confronted Joe, who, in the agent's words, was very self-contained, sullen, and wicked-appearing. Another investigator had separately asked Joe, "Were you thick with Annie?" "No, I was never," he said. Joe gave the same alibi Rose did. On the night of May 21, 1921, they had been together in Pawnee, 17 miles southwest of Gray Horse, and had stopped at a rooming house. The owner of the rooming house, which was one of those seething places that often reeked of sex and moonshine, supported Joe and Rose's claims. The investigators noticed, however, that the stories told by Rose and Joe were almost verbatim, as if they had rehearsed them. Rose and Joe were released, and afterward Agent Berger sought the help of an informant, the bootlegger and dope peddler Kelsey Morrison, who seemed an ideal source of intelligence. He'd once been married to an Osage woman and was close to Rose and other suspects. Before Agent Berger could recruit Morrison, though, he needed to find him. Morrison had fled Osage County after assaulting a local prohibition officer. Berger and other agents made inquiries and learned that Morrison was in Dallas, Texas, using the alias Lloyd Miller. The agent sprang a trap. They had a registered letter sent to the P.O. box listed under Miller's name, then they nabbed Morrison when he went to retrieve it. "We interviewed Lloyd Miller, who, for about an hour, denied that he was Kelsey Morrison, but finally admitted that he was," Agent Berger reported. Morrison, whom Agent Berger described as an unusually shrewd and reckless and self-confessed criminal, dressed like a dance hall hustler, tall, bullet-scarred, small-eyed, and jittery, he seemed to be wasting away from within, hence his nickname, Slim.
"Talks and smokes cigarettes a lot," Agent Berger noted in a report. "Sniffs nose and works mouth and nose like rabbit almost continuously, especially when excited."
The feds cut a deal with Morrison. In return for getting his arrest warrant for assault quashed, he would work as an informant on the Osage murder cases. Agent Berger told headquarters,
"This arrangement is strictly confidential and not to be divulged outside of this bureau to anyone, under any circumstances."
There was a risk that Morrison might slip away, and before releasing him, Agent Berger made sure they'd gone through a rigorous process known as bertillonage. Devised by the French criminologist Alphonse Bertillon in 1879, it was the first scientific method for identifying repeat criminals. Using a caliper and other special tools, Agent Berger, with the help of the Dallas police, took 11 of Morrison's body measurements. Among them were the length of his left foot, the width and length of his head, and the diameter of his right ear. After Agent Berger informed Morrison of the purpose of these measurements, he also commissioned a mugshot, another of Bertillon's innovations. In 1894, Ida Tarbell, the muckraking journalist, wrote that any prisoner who passed through Bertillon's system would be forever spotted. He may efface his tattooing, compress his chest, dye his hair, extract his teeth, scar his body, dissimulate his height. It is useless. But Bertillonage was already being displaced by a more efficient method of identification that was revolutionizing the world of scientific detection, fingerprinting. In some cases, a suspect could now be placed at the scene of a crime even without a witness present. When Hoover became the Bureau's acting director, he created the Identification Division, a central repository for the fingerprints of arrested criminals from around the country. Such scientific methods, Hoover proclaimed, would assist the guardians of civilization in the face of the common danger. Agent Berger had Morrison's fingertips dabbed in ink. We have his picture, description, measurements, and fingerprints in the event we have cause to apprehend him, he informed headquarters. He then gave Morrison some spending money. Morrison promised to visit Rose Osage and Joe Allen as well as members of the underworld to see what he could learn about the murders. Morrison warned that if anyone discovered he was working for the feds, it would mean his death. He reported back that he had asked Rose regarding Anna's murder, "Why'd you do it?" And she replied, "You don't know a goddamn thing about it, Slim. I did not kill Anna." In a memo, Agent Berger noted of his prized informant, "If he is not bumped off too soon, he can do us a lot of good." White now reviewed all the information that had been gathered by Morrison and the agents regarding Rose Osage and Joe Allen. In light of Rose's statement to Morrison and the fact that the rooming house owner had confirmed Rose and Joe's alibi, the Kaw Indian statement that Rose had confessed to her seemed puzzling. One detail in particular was curious. According to the Kaw Indian's account of Rose's confession, Anna was in the car when Rose shot her, and her body was then dumped at Three Mile Creek, where Rose also discarded her own blood-stained clothes. The autopsy findings were telling. Criminologists had come to understand that blood coagulates at the lowest point of a body after death, producing dark splotches on the skin. If, when one finds a corpse, these splotches appear on the higher regions, it is a sign that someone has moved the body. In Anna's case, the doctors had not reported any indications of this, and from all the descriptions of the crime scene, there had been no trail of blood from the car down to the creek. It seemed that the witness must be lying and that Rose and Joe were innocent. This would explain why the dictograph set up by the private detectives working for Molly Burkhart's family had never picked up any incriminating statements and why Rose's clothes had never been found in the creek. When agents interrogated the Kaw Indian, it didn't take much for her to crack. She admitted that Rose had never told her any such story about the killing. In fact, a strange white man had come to her house, written up the statement, and forced her to sign it, even though none of it was true. White realized that the conspirators were not only erasing evidence, they were manufacturing it. 11. The Third Man. Hoover immediately began pestering White for updates. Once, when White was in the field and did not respond immediately, Hoover chastised him, saying, "I do not understand why at the end of the day you could not have wired me fully as to the developments and general situation." Hoover's attention to the case had waxed and waned over the years, but he had become so agitated about the growing criticism he was receiving in Oklahoma that prior to White's arrival he had started to investigate matters himself. Though he was not one to venture into the muck of the field, he had a phobia of germs and had installed in his home a special filtration system to purify the air. He would sit in his office, poring over incoming reports from agents, his eyes and ears on the menacing world.
As Hoover studied the reports on the Osage murders, he found it an interesting observation that Anna Brown and Roan were both killed with a bullet to the back of the head, and after carefully going over all of the angles, he came to believe that a white woman, Nasia Kinney, who was married to an Osage man, might hold the key to the case. Kinney had told agents that A.W. Comstock, the attorney who served as a guardian for several Osage, was likely part of the conspiracy. Hoover hadn't forgotten that Comstock had criticized the Bureau and had threatened to turn Senator Curtis against him, which made Comstock in Hoover's eyes a malicious rat.
"I am convinced that Mrs. Kinney is pretty well on the right track," Hoover had told one of his agents.
Kinney had a history of mental instability. She claimed to be possessed by spells, and she had once even attempted to murder another local attorney. Still, Hoover himself had interviewed her in Washington not once but twice, and he arranged for a government expert on mental diseases to evaluate her. The doctor concluded that she was paranoid, but noted, as Hoover put it, that she perceives items which would escape the observation of the average individual. As a result, Hoover said, Kinney is of greater value to us in furnishing leads than she would be possibly as a witness. White hadn't been able to substantiate Kinney's allegations, but he wasn't sure what to make of Comstock either. Armed with his English bulldog revolver, Comstock was one of the few prominent white citizens in Osage County who seemed willing to assist investigators. He had told agents that he was sure he could secure critical evidence if only he could have access to the Bureau's files. White refused to share any confidential records. Still, Comstock would routinely come to see White, sharing helpful tidbits of information and checking on the progress of the investigation. Then he would disappear into the streets with his gleaming English bulldog. By the end of July 1925, White had turned his full attention to the last of the listed suspects in Anna Brown's murder, Brian Burkhart, Molly's brother-in-law. White learned that during the inquest in 1921, Brian had stated that on the night Anna disappeared, he'd taken her straight home from Ernest and Molly's house, dropping her off between 4:30 and 5 p.m. Brian then headed into Fairfax, where he was seen with Hale, Ernest, and his visiting uncle and aunt, who went with him to watch the musical Bringing Up Father. There wouldn't have been time for him to go to the creek, shoot Anna, and return to town before the show started. His alibi seemed airtight. To corroborate it, Agent Berger and a colleague had earlier traveled to Campbell, a town in northern Texas where Ernest and Brian's aunt and uncle lived. The agent sped past the old trails that cowboys had once followed, trails that were now supplanted by cattle cars pulled by shrieking locomotives. Agents discovered that Hale had grown up in a wooded grove only a few miles from Campbell. His mother had died when he was 3 years old. The king of the Osage Hills, too, burdened by a past. In Campbell, agents stopped at the austere house of Brian's uncle and aunt. The uncle was away, but the aunt invited the investigators inside and launched into a venomous rant about how Ernest had married one of those red millionaires. Berger asked her about the night Anna disappeared. Oh, she'd heard the whispers about how Brian was responsible for killing that drunken Indian, she said, but none of it was true. After dropping Anna off, Brian had joined the rest of the party in Fairfax. The uncle suddenly appeared at the front door. He seemed displeased to find a pair of federal agents inside his home. He was reluctant to speak, but he confirmed that Brian had met them in Fairfax after dropping Anna off. He added that after the show, he and his wife had spent the evening in the same house with Brian and that Brian was there the whole time. He simply couldn't have been the murderer. The uncle then made it clear that he wanted the agents to get the hell out. In August 1925, White sent his undercover operatives to infiltrate the town of Ralston. White wanted his team to investigate a lead that had not been properly followed up. On the night Anna Brown disappeared, case records showed, she might have been spotted in a car by a group of white men who was sitting in front of a hotel on Ralston's main street. Previous investigators, including local lawmen and the private eyes, had spoken to these valuable witnesses and then seemingly buried what they had learned. At least one of the witnesses had since vanished, and White was convinced that, as one agent had noted in a report, such people were being paid by suspects to go away and stay away.
White and his men tried to track down some of the witnesses outside the hotel, including an elderly farmer who had been questioned earlier by an agent. During that initial interview, the farmer had seemed to be suffering from dementia. He had stared at the agent blankly. After a while, though, he had perked up. His memory was just fine, he explained. He'd simply wanted to make sure that the investigators were who they said they were. Talking to the wrong person about these murders was liable to get one planted in the ground. The farmer now spoke to White and his men. According to testimony that the farmer subsequently gave under oath, he remembered that evening well because he'd often discussed it with friends of his who gathered regularly at the hotel. "We old fellows have a lot of time in town, and that is where we sit down," he said. He recalled that the car had stopped by the curb, and through its open window he could see Anna. She was right there in front of him. She said hello, and someone in the group said back, "Hello, Annie." The farmer's wife, who had been with him in Ralston that night, was also certain that the woman in the car was Anna, though she didn't talk to her. "There was Indians so much around there," she testified. "Sometimes I spoke to one, and sometimes I didn't. Sometimes when I spoke to one, they didn't speak." Asked if Anna had been slumped over from drinking, she said, "Just sitting like they all sit, just about like this." She posed herself straight and rigid, like a statue, her rendition of a stoic Indian. At one point she was asked if anyone had been with Anna in the car. "Yes, sir," the farmer's wife said.
"Who?"
"Brian Burkhart." Brian, she said, had been driving the car and wearing a cowboy hat. Another witness said that he also saw Brian with Anna in the car. "They went straight west from there, right on through town, and I don't know where they went from there," the witness recalled. It was the first proven crack in Brian's alibi. He might have taken Anna home, but he'd eventually gone back out with her. As an agent wrote in a report, Brian perjured himself when he swore before the coroner's inquest at Fairfax that he had left Anna safely at her home in Fairfax between 4:30 and 5 p.m. White needed to establish where the two had gone after leaving Ralston. Piecing together details from Agent Berger's previous informants as well as from witnesses located by the undercover team, White was able to create a timeline. Brian and Anna had stopped at a nearby speakeasy and stayed there until about 10 p.m. Then they headed to another hell joint several miles north of Fairfax. Brian's uncle was spotted with them, so perhaps the uncle had been lying to Agent Berger to cover not only for Brian but for himself as well. The owner of the place told agents that Brian and Anna had been drinking there until about 1 a.m. Accounts of where Brian and Anna went after that grew murkier. One witness said that they'd stopped alone at another speakeasy closer to Fairfax. Others reported seeing Brian and Anna leave the speakeasy in the company of a third man, who wasn't the uncle. "Third man is said to have been present with Anna Brown and Brian Burkhart," Agent Berger noted. The last sighting of Anna and Brian together that the investigators heard about had been at approximately 3 a.m. A witness who knew them both said that she'd heard a car stop near her house in Fairfax. A man whom she believed to be Brian shouted, "Stop your foolishness, Annie, and get into this car." After that, there was no trace of Anna. She'd been ghosted. Brian's neighbor, though, spotted him returning home at sunrise. Brian later told the neighbor not to say a word to anybody and gave him money to keep quiet. White had homed in on a prime suspect. But as with many mysteries, each answer to a question opened up another question. If Brian had killed Anna, what was his motive? Was he involved in the other murders? And who was the third man? 12. A Wilderness of Mirrors. By the end of that summer, White began to suspect that there was a mole inside the investigation. When one of his agents was questioning a seedy local attorney who, according to an informant, was trying to strangle the government's probe, the attorney betrayed a shocking knowledge of the inner workings of the case. Finally, he admitted that he'd seen parts of the reports made by the Bureau and had an opportunity to see more of them. The Bureau's probe had long been plagued by leaks and sabotage. One agent complained that information contained in reports immediately gets into the possession of unauthorized and unscrupulous persons. A U.S. attorney also discovered that the reports furnished to him by the Bureau had vanished from his office. The breaches threatened the lives of agents and created insidious doubts, with officials questioning each other's loyalty. One federal prosecutor demanded that no copy of his report be handed to any representative of the state of Oklahoma. Perhaps most damagingly, two private eyes, including one from the Burns Agency, tried to expose the Bureau's main informant, Kelsey Morrison. These private eyes leaked to several local officials that Morrison was working with the Bureau, then went so far as to detain him on a trumped-up robbery charge. Agent Berger said that the conduct of one of these private detectives was reprehensible and was certainly hurting our investigation. Obstruction, he noted, appeared to be these private detectives' sole object, adding, "Someone must be paying them to do this." An agent reported that Morrison, after being released from jail, seemed frightened out of his wits. During one of their meetings, Morrison beseeched agents to get the son of bitches who did the killings before they got him. Agent Berger warned Morrison, "Look out for double-crossing and traps." At night, White sometimes met with his team in the countryside, the men huddling in the dark like fugitives. Agents in the past had sensed that they were being followed, and White gave his men advice in case their cover was blown. "Keep your balance. Avoid any rough stuff if possible." Making it clear that they should carry weapons, he added, "But if you have to fight to survive, do a good job." White found himself wandering through a wilderness of mirrors, his work more akin to espionage than to criminal investigation. There were moles and double agents and possibly triple agents. No one had aroused more suspicion than the private eye called Pike. A gentleman in Osage County had once approached Agent Berger and introduced himself as an intermediary, a go-between for Pike. Agents were aware that Pike had been hired by William Hale back in 1921 to solve the Osage murders, but had abandoned the case after failing to make any progress. The intermediary, however, said that Pike had actually withheld a crucial piece of information that he had discovered during his investigation. He knew the identity of the third man who'd been spotted with Brian and Anna around the time that she was killed. Agent Berger wrote that Pike apparently has known and talked with this third man. But the intermediary made it clear that Pike would share this information under one condition, that he be paid a king's ransom. "It is quite apparent there is some crooked work afoot," Agent Berger wrote in a report. Agents demanded through the intermediary that Pike come forward. But again, he didn't comply, evidently determined to extort money and obstruct justice. Agents launched a manhunt for Pike, whose last known address was in Kansas City.
"Pike will have to be located and apprehended," Agent Berger wrote. "He changed his Kansas City address soon after it became known that we were working on him. We feel sure he has been paid to skip."
Not long after, Pike was caught allegedly committing highway robbery in Tulsa. Out of angles to play, he gave up a name of a local gambler. Agents could confirm that the gambler had been at one of the speakeasies drinking with Brian and Anna on the night of May 21st, but further investigation proved that the gambler had gone home too early to be the third man. It seemed as if the agents had once more been duped. But they continued to work on Pike, to pressure him, and over time he began to reveal, little by little, a hidden dimension to the case. He disclosed that he'd never really been hired to solve the murder of Anna Brown. In fact, he'd been asked to conceal Brian's whereabouts on the night of the crime. Pike told agents that he was supposed to manufacture evidence and to generate false witnesses, to shape an alibi, as he put it. What's more, he claimed that his orders had come directly from William Hale. Pike explained that Hale took pains never to say explicitly that Brian had been involved in Anna's murder, but this was evident from what Hale was asking him to do. If Pike was telling the truth, it meant that Hale, a seeming paragon of law and order who had held himself up as Molly Burkhart's most staunch protector, had been lying all these years about Anna's murder. Pike could not answer what White wanted to know most. Was Hale merely protecting Brian, or was he part of a more intricate, nefarious design? Pike, though, told agents one more thing that was startling. When he met with Hale and Brian, Pike said, there was sometimes another person present. Ernest Burkhart. Pike added that Ernest was careful never to discuss this case or talk it over with him in the presence of Molly Burkhart. 13. A hangman's son. The first time that Tom White saw a criminal hanged, he was just a boy, and the executioner was his father. In 1888, his father, Robert Emmett White, was elected sheriff of Travis County, Texas, which included Austin, then a city of fewer than 15,000 people. A towering man with a dense mustache, Emmett, as Tom's father liked to be called, was poor, stern, hard-working, and pious. In 1870, at the age of 18, he migrated from Tennessee to the still wild frontier of central Texas. 4 years later, he married Tom's mother, Maggie. They lived in a log cabin in the desolate hill country outside Austin, where they herded cattle and scratched the earth for whatever food it might yield. Tom, who was born in 1881, was the third of their five children. Among them was Doc, the youngest, and Dudley, Tom's bruising older brother, with whom he was particularly close. The nearest schoolhouse, which had one room and a single teacher for 8 grades, was 3 miles away, and to get there Tom and his siblings had to walk. When Tom was 6, his mother died, apparently from complications after childbirth. Her body was laid in a plot where Tom could see the grass growing over her. Emmett was left to raise Tom and his siblings, all of whom were under the age of 10. A 19th-century book profiling distinguished Texans said of Emmett, "Mr. White belongs to that class of solid, substantial farmers of which Travis County can boast. He is well known in the county, and the people have the greatest confidence in his energy and integrity of character." In 1888, a delegation of townsfolk besieged Emmett to run for county sheriff, which he did, winning easily. And so Tom's father became the law. As sheriff, Emmett was in charge of the county jail in Austin, and he moved with his children into a house adjoining the building. The jail resembled a fortress, with barred windows and cold stone passageways and tiered cells. In Emmett's first year, the jail held nearly 300 prisoners, including 4 murderers, 65 thieves, 2 arsonists, 24 burglars, 2 forgers, 5 rapists, and 24 inmates classified as lunatics. Tom later recalled, "I was raised practically right in the jail. I could look down from my bedroom window and see the jail corridor and the doors to some of the cells." It was as if the scripture were unfolding before his eyes, good and evil, redemption and damnation. One time a melee broke out in the prison. As Sheriff White tried to quell the riot, his children ran to the nearby courthouse calling for help. The Austin Weekly Statesman published a story about the incident under the headline, "Blood, Blood, Blood. The county jail turned into a veritable slaughter pen." The reporter described the scene that young Tom had encountered. "The writer has seen many bloody and sickening sights in his experience in newspaper work, but none of them approached the disgusting sight that met his gaze when he entered the county jail yesterday afternoon about 5:30. Turn which way he might, nothing was to be seen but blood." After the incident in which 5 men were badly injured, Emmett White became a firm, even unyielding sheriff. Still, he showed remarkable consideration toward the people in his custody and insisted on making arrests without brandishing his six-shooter. He did not philosophize about the law or his responsibilities, but Tom noticed that he always maintained the same manner, no matter whether the prisoners were black or white or Mexican. At the time, extrajudicial lynchings, particularly of blacks in the South, were one of the most egregious failures of the American legal system. Whenever Emmett heard that locals were planning to throw a necktie party, he would rush out to try to stop it. "If a mob attempts to take the Negro from the sheriff," a reporter noted in one case, "there will be trouble." Emmett refused to put young nonviolent prisoners in the jail alongside older, more dangerous convicts, and because there was no other place for them, he let them stay in his own house, living with his children. One girl remained with them for weeks on end. Tom never knew why she was in jail, and his father never discussed it. Tom often puzzled over why criminals did what they did. Some of the prison's inmates seemed bad through and through, the devil born in them. Some seemed sick in the head, seeing things that other people couldn't see. Many of the prisoners, though, had been driven to a desperate act, often something violent and despicable, and afterward they were penitent, seeking redemption. In some ways, these convicts were the most frightening to contemplate, for they demonstrated that badness could take hold of anyone. Tom attended a local Baptist church with his family, and the preacher said that everyone was a sinner, even Emmett, the upholder of justice. These were mysteries that Tom might never solve, though he seemed to spend most of his life trying. Tom watched his father work. At all hours of the day, including on the Sabbath, Emmett would be summoned to hunt men. Criminology was still primitive. Emmett grabbed his gun, canvassed any witnesses to the crime, then mounted his horse and went in pursuit. He also kept a pack of bloodhounds, which he sometimes deployed in the chase. One summer day in 1892, when Tom was 11, his father hurried out with the bloodhounds. A family man had been gunned down while riding his horse. Tom's father noticed that 30 paces from where the victim lay, there was a spot of trampled earth and a burned ammunition wad. It was the place where the killer had stood. White unleashed the hounds, and they picked up the killer's trail, which curiously led right back to the dead man's house. As Sheriff White gathered evidence from witnesses, he learned that the victim's slayer was his own son. A few weeks later, Tom's father was summoned again, this time in pursuit of a rapist. A headline in the Statesman read, "Ravished in broad day. Mrs. D.C. Evans dragged from her buggy, brutally assaulted, and then outraged. The officers hot on the trail of the brutal wretch." Despite a grueling chase, the rapist eluded capture. In such cases, Tom's father withdrew into himself, as if tormented by some dreadful sickness. Once before he apprehended a fugitive, a reporter observed, "Truth to tell, Sheriff White's every thought, day and night, was of the man, so much so that his capture soon became a part of Sheriff White's very existence." Every time the sheriff headed out into the dark, the bloodhounds howling, Tom had to live with the terrible uncertainty that his father might never return, that like Tom's mother he might disappear from this world forever. Though it took enormous courage and virtue to risk your life in order to protect society, such selflessness also contained, at least from the vantage point of your loved ones, a hint of cruelty. Once, a desperado put a gun to Emmett's head. Somehow he managed to wrestle the weapon free. Another time, at the jail, a prisoner pulled a knife and stabbed his father from behind. Tom could see the knife protruding from his father's back, blood gushing onto the floor. It was amazing how much blood was inside a man, inside his father. The prisoner tried to twist the knife, and his father seemed ready to give up the ghost, when suddenly he drove his finger into the prisoner's eye, causing the eye to pop out. Tom could see it dangling from the socket. His father subdued the prisoner, but Tom would relive that scene all his life. How could one forgive a sinner who tried to kill one's own father? The first hanging that Tom witnessed was carried out in January 1894. A 19-year-old black man, Ed Nichols, had been convicted of raping a girl and sentenced to be hung by the neck until he is dead. The duty of performing an execution, which hadn't occurred in the county for a decade, fell to the sheriff. Tom's father hired a carpenter to construct the gallows near the southern wall of the prison, the only place where the ceiling was sufficiently high. The location was 10 feet from Nichols' cell, and the condemned man, who maintained his innocence and still hoped for a reprieve from the governor, could hear the planks being sawed and nailed, the pace quickening. Tom's father was determined to make the killing mercifully swift, and once the apparatus was completed, he repeatedly tested it with sacks of sand. The governor rejected Nichols' final appeal, saying, "Let the law take its course." Tom's father broke the news to Nichols, who was in his cell deep in prayer. Nichols tried to stay calm, but his hands began to tremble. He said that he'd like to be clean-shaven and wear a fine black suit for his appointment with death, and Tom's father promised to honor his wishes. On the day of the execution, Tom, who was 12 years old, stood on a tier inside the jail. No one shooed him away, not even his father, and he could see Nichols, who was dressed in his new suit, being led by Tom's father to the scaffolding, time measured in each step and breath. As Tom listened, a preacher read Nichols' final statement. "Sheriff White has been very accommodating to me indeed. I feel prepared to meet death. My soul is at peace with all mankind." Then the preacher offered his own holy words. "Ed Nichols is to swing into eternity," he said. "Sheriff Death is on his black steed. He is but a short distance away, coming to arrest the soul of this man, to meet the trial at the higher bar, where God himself is supreme ruler, Jesus, his son, the attorney, and the Holy Ghost, the prosecutor." When the preacher finished, Tom heard a familiar voice. It was his father, reading the death warrant. The noose was fitted around Nichols' neck and a black hood placed over his head. Tom could no longer see Nichols' face, but he could see his father holding the lever for the trap door. At 2 minutes before 4 in the afternoon, his father sprang the trap. The body fell before jerking violently upward. Then a sound of astonishment and horror rippled through the crowd. Despite all the meticulous construction, Nichols was still moving, still trembling with life. "He kicked and jerked around a long time," Tom later recalled. "It seemed like he would never give up and die. Finally, his body stopped moving and was cut down from the rope." Perhaps because he witnessed this and other executions, or perhaps because he had seen the effect of the ordeal on his father, or perhaps because he feared that the system could doom an innocent man, Tom grew to oppose what was then sometimes called judicial homicide. And he came to see the law as a struggle to subdue the violent passions not only in others, but also in oneself. In 1905, when Tom was 24, he enlisted in the Texas Rangers. Created in the 19th century as a volunteer citizen militia to fight American Indians on the frontier and later Mexicans along the border, the Rangers had evolved into a kind of state police force. American Indians and Mexicans had long despised the Rangers for their brutal shoot-first methods. But among white Texans, they were widely mythologized. As Lyndon B. Johnson later put it, "Every schoolboy in Texas cuts his eye teeth on stories about the Texas Rangers. I wasn't any exception." Tom's brother Dudley, equally entranced by the Ranger mystique, entered the force the same year as Tom, and Doc soon joined them. Later, Tom's brother Coley followed even more closely in their father's footsteps, becoming the sheriff of Travis County. Doc recalled the simple advice that his father gave him upon becoming a lawman. "Get all the evidence you can, son, then put yourself in the criminal's place. Think it out. Plug up those holes, son." Like Doc and Dudley, who were each placed in separate ranger companies, Tom received a meager salary of $40 per month, the same as a cowpuncher, as he put it. Tom joined his company at a campsite 65 miles west of Abilene. Another ranger had once observed upon arriving in camp, "Here was a scene worthy of the pencil. Men in groups with long beards and mustaches, dressed in every variety of garment, with one exception, the slouched hat, the unmistakable uniform of a Texas Ranger, and a belt of pistols around their waists, were occupied drying their blankets, cleaning and fixing their guns, and some employed cooking at different fires while others were grooming their horses. A rougher-looking set we never saw." Tom learned to be a lawman by following the example of the most skilled officers. If you observed carefully and if you weren't too busy liquoring or whoring, which many of the Rangers were, you could learn how to track a horse through the brush even if, as Tom once found, the thieves had deceptively turned the horseshoes backward. You picked up little tricks, overturning your boots each morning in case a scorpion or some other critter had crept inside, shaking out your blanket for rattlesnakes before lying down at night. You discovered how to avoid quicksand and how to locate streams and otherwise parched land. You understood that it was better to ride a black horse and dress in black like a personification of evil so as not to be scoped by a gunman in the night. Tom soon received the orders for one of his first missions. He was to accompany his captain and his sergeant in pursuit of cow rustlers in Kent County, north of Abilene. At one point, Tom and the sergeant paused at a store to get provisions. They tied up their horses and were heading inside when the sergeant asked Tom where his Winchester rifle was. Tom told him that it was in his scabbard on his horse. The sergeant, a man of explosive temperament, yelled, "You don't never do that! Go get your Winchester right now and bring it in here and keep it right with you all the time." Tom, chastened, retrieved his rifle, and it was not long before he understood the sergeant's urgency. They were being tracked by the rustlers. They had to dodge being shot several times before they finally arrested the gang. Tom became increasingly adept at dealing with what he called rascality. Cow rustlers, horse thieves, scallywags, pimps, rum runners, stagecoach robbers, desperados, and other human transgressors. When he was sent with another ranger, Oscar Roundtree, to clean up the lawless town of Bowie, a pastor wrote to White's captain saying that he had witnessed the lawless element completely driven from our town by the two rangers you sent here. During his time as a ranger, Tom investigated several murders. Tom's brother Doc recalled, "We had nothing, not even fingerprints. We had to use mostly witnesses, and they were sometimes hard to come by. Even more troublesome, some rangers had no patience for the niceties of the law. One member of Tom's company would seek out the most ruthless bad man in town and then provoke a fight so he could kill him. Tom, who believed that a lawman could usually avoid killing if you didn't lose your head, later told the writer that he had heated discussions with this ranger. It didn't seem right for any man to play judge, jury, and executioner. In 1908, while Tom was stationed in Weatherford, a town east of Abilene, he met a young woman named Bessie Patterson. She was petite, at least beside him, and she had short brown hair and sincere eyes. Tom, who'd spent much of his life in male company, was taken with her. Where he was a man of stillness, she was outspoken in a whirl of motion. She ordered him around in a way that few dared, but he didn't seem to mind. For once, it was not incumbent upon him to be in command of the world around him or the emotions inside him. His job, however, was ill-suited for marriage. Doc's captain once said, "An officer who hunts desperate criminals has no business having a wife and family." Before long, Tom was tugged away from her. With N.P. Thomas, a ranger who was one of his closest friends, he was sent to deal with a plague of rascality in Amarillo in the Texas Panhandle. A ranger reported that the city had some of the hardest crooks around and that the sheriff's office had provided no assistance in removing them. What's more, the ranger noted, the sheriff has two sons who live at the whorehouse. Thomas had already had several run-ins with the deputy sheriff, and one January morning in 1909, N.P. Thomas was sitting in the county prosecutor's office when the deputy leveled his gun and shot him in the face. Thomas fell forward, blood gushing from his mouth. When the medics arrived, he was still breathing, but they couldn't stop the bleeding, and he died in agony. Many of the men with whom Tom had served in the Rangers went prematurely to their deaths. Tom saw both inexperienced and veteran officers die. He saw irresponsible lawmen die, and conscientious ones, too. Roundtree, who became a deputy sheriff, was shot in the head by a rich landowner. The ranger with whom Tom argued about usurping the law joined a posse of vigilantes and was accidentally shot and killed by one of his own men. Tom's sergeant was shot 6 times by an assailant while a bystander was struck twice. As the sergeant lay on the ground bleeding, he asked for a slip of paper and scribbled on it a message for ranger headquarters. "I am shot all to pieces. Everything quiet." Somehow he survived his wounds, but the innocent bystander died. Then there was the time that a new recruit in Tom's company was gunned down while trying to stop an assault. Tom collected the ranger's body and transported it to the home of his parents, who couldn't fathom why their boy was in a box suckering maggots. After N.P. Thomas's death, Tom felt a lawlessness within him. A friend of Tom's who wrote a short sketch of his life said, "Tom's emotional struggle was brief but violent. Should he attempt to avenge Thomas's death?" Tom decided to leave the Rangers altogether and marry Bessie. The adjutant general wrote to Tom's captain saying that Tom had proved an excellent officer and that he would regret to see him quit the service. But his decision was final. He and Bessie settled in San Antonio, where the first of their two sons was born. Tom became a railroad detective, and the steady wage made it possible to raise a family. Though he still chased bandits on horseback, the work was generally less dangerous. In many cases, it involved unmasking individuals who had filed false claims for reimbursements. Tom found these people cowards, and therefore more contemptible than the desperados who risked their lives to hold up a train. Tom was a dedicated family man, but like his father, he was attracted to the darkness. And in 1917, he took the oath to become a special agent of the Bureau of Investigation. He swore, "I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies. So help me God." In July 1918, not long after Tom joined the Bureau, his brother Dudley went with another ranger to arrest a pair of deserters in a remote wooded area in East Texas known as the Big Thicket. It was during an obliterating drought, and amid the dust and heat, Dudley and his partner searched a clapboard house where the two wanted men were believed to be hiding out. The suspects weren't there, so Dudley and his partner decided to wait on the porch. At 3 a.m, the darkness was suddenly ablaze with gunfire. The deserters had ambushed them. Dudley's partner was shot twice, and as he lay bleeding on the porch, he could see Dudley standing and firing one of his six-shooters. Then Dudley was falling, as if someone had undercut his legs, his massive frame smashing against the porch. His partner later recalled that he fell and did not get up again. A bullet had struck Dudley near the heart. Tom was overcome by the news. His brother, who was married and had 3 children under the age of 8, had seemed invulnerable to Tom. The 2 deserters were caught and prosecuted for murder, and Tom's father attended each day of the trial until both men were convicted. After the shooting, Dudley's corpse was transported home. A ranger report noted clinically, "One wagon sheet, 1 bed sheet, 1 pillow, used in shipping Ranger White's body." Tom and his family retrieved Dudley's possessions, including the soft-nosed, steel-jacketed bullet that had killed him. He was buried in a cemetery near the ranch where he was born. As the Bible said, "For dust you are, and to dust you will return." An obelisk by his grave read, "John Dudley White, Sr., Headquarters Company, Texas Rangers. Killed in line of duty, July 12, 1918. 2 weeks after the funeral, a cool rain finally began to fall, washing over the prairie. By then, Tom had returned to the Bureau of Investigation. 14. Dying Words. In September 1925, as White tried to determine what secrets William Hale and his nephews Ernest and Brian were hiding, he wondered if one person had previously uncovered them. Bill Smith, Molly Burkhart's brother-in-law. It was Smith who had first suspected that Lizzie was poisoned, and he who had investigated whether there was a larger conspiracy connected to the family's oil wealth. If Smith was killed because of what he had learned, that information might be the key to unlocking the inside world. After the explosion destroyed the Smiths' house, agents asked the nurse who had been on duty when Bill was being treated in the hospital whether he had mentioned anything about the murders. She said that Bill had often muttered names in his feverish sleep, but she had been unable to make them out. Sometimes when he woke up, he seemed worried that he might have said something in his sleep,
something that he shouldn't have.
Shortly before Bill died, the nurse recalled, he had met with his doctors, James and David Schoen, and with his lawyer. The doctors had asked the nurse to leave the room. It was clear that they didn't want her to overhear their conversation with Bill, and she suspected that he had given some sort of statement indicating who was responsible for blowing up his house. White, already suspicious of the Schoens owing to the missing bullet in the Anna Brown case, began to question each person who had been in the room with Bill. Later, federal prosecutors also questioned these men. According to a transcript of these interrogations, David Schoen acknowledged that he and his brother had summoned the lawyer, believing that Bill might name his killers, but nothing came of it.
"If Bill Smith had an idea who blowed him up, he never said," the doctor recalled.
One of the prosecutors pressed him about why it had been so important for the nurse to leave the room.
Schoen explained that nurses often leave when the doctors come in.
"If she says that you asked her to step out, she lies?"
"No, sir, if she says that, I did."
Schoen said he would swear a dozen times that Bill never identified his killers. Pointing to his hat, he added, "Bill Smith gave me that hat, and he is my friend." James Schoen, David's brother, was equally adamant, telling the prosecutor he never did say who blew him up.
"He must have talked about that."
"He never did say who blew him up."
"Did he talk about who blew him up?"
"He didn't talk about who blew him up."
When Bill Smith's lawyer was questioned, he too insisted that he had no idea who was responsible for blowing up the Smith's house.
"Gentlemen, it is a mystery to me," he said, but as he was being grilled, he revealed that in the hospital, Bill Smith had said, "You know, I only had two enemies in the world," and that those enemies were William K. Hale, the king of the Osage Hills, and his nephew, Ernest Burkhart. The investigators asked James Schoen about this, and eventually he divulged the truth.
"I would hate to say positively that he said that Bill Hale blew him up, but he did say Bill Hale was his only enemy."
"What did he say about Ernest Burkhart?" a prosecutor asked.
"He said they were the only two enemies he knew of."
The Schoens were close to Hale and the Burkharts, having been their family's physicians, and not long after the conversation at the hospital, one of the Schoen brothers informed the nurse that Brian Burkhart was ill. She was asked to visit Brian at his house, and she agreed to do so. While she was there, Hale showed up. He conferred privately with Brian, then approached the nurse. After some small talk, he asked her if Bill Smith had named his killers before he died. The nurse told him, "If he did, I would not be telling it." Hale seemed to be trying to ascertain whether she knew anything and perhaps to be warning her not to divulge a word if she did. As White and agents dug deeper into the hospital statement, they began to suspect that the doctors had orchestrated the private meeting with Bill Smith not for his testimony, but rather for another ulterior motive. During the meeting, James Schoen was named the administrator of the estate of Bill Smith's murdered wife, Rita, which allowed him to execute her will. Such a position was coveted by Weiss, for it paid unconscionably high fees and provided ample opportunities for graft. After White's team uncovered the scheme, one of the prosecutors questioned David Schoen about it.
"You understand in your study of medicine the requisite of a dying declaration," he said. "You weren't undertaking to get anything like that?"
"No," Schoen replied meekly.
It was now clear why the doctors had summoned not the sheriff or a prosecutor, but Bill Smith's personal attorney. They had asked him to bring the paperwork for Bill to sign before he died. Another prosecutor asked David Schoen if Bill was even lucid enough to make such a decision.
"Did he know what he was signing?"
"I suppose he did. He was supposed to be rational."
"You are a doctor. Was he rational?"
"He was rational."
"And he made arrangements for your brother to be appointed for his wife's estate?"
"Yes, sir."
After further interrogation, he conceded,
"A very wealthy estate."
The more White investigated the flow of oil money from Osage headrights, the more he found layer upon layer of corruption. Although some White guardians and administrators tried to act in the best interests of the tribe, countless others used the system to swindle the very people they were ostensibly protecting. Many guardians would purchase for their wards goods from their own stores or inventories at inflated prices. One guardian bought a car for $250 and then resold it to his ward for $1,250. Or guardians would direct all of their ward's business to certain stores and banks in return for kickbacks. Or guardians would claim to be buying homes and land for their wards while really buying these for themselves. Or guardians would outright steal. One government study estimated that before 1925, guardians had pilfered at least $8 million directly from the restricted accounts of their Osage wards. The blackest chapter in the history of this state will be the Indian guardianship over these estates, an Osage leader said, adding, "There has been millions, not thousands, but millions of dollars of many of the Osages dissipated and spent by the guardians themselves." This so-called Indian business, as White discovered, was an elaborate criminal operation in which various sectors of society were complicit. The crooked guardians and administrators of Osage estates were typically among the most prominent white citizens, businessmen and ranchers and lawyers and politicians. So were the lawmen and prosecutors and judges who facilitated and concealed the swindling, and sometimes acted as guardians and administrators themselves. In 1924, the Indian Rights Association, which defended the interests of indigenous communities, conducted an investigation into what it described as an orgy of graft and exploitation. The group documented how rich Indians in Oklahoma were being shamelessly and openly robbed in a scientific and ruthless manner, and how guardianships were the plums to be distributed to the faithful friends of the judges as a reward for their support at the polls. Judges were known to say to citizens, "You vote for me, and I will see that you get a good guardianship." A white woman married to an Osage man described to a reporter how the locals would plot. A group of traders and lawyers sprung up who selected certain Indians as their prey. They owned all the officials. These men had an understanding with each other. They cold-bloodedly said, "You take so-and-so, so-and-so, and so-and-so, and I'll take these." They selected Indians who had full head rights and large farms. Some of the schemes were beyond depraved. The Indian Rights Association detailed the case of a widow whose guardian had absconded with most of her possessions. Then the guardian falsely informed the woman who had moved from Osage County that she had no more money to draw on, leaving her to raise her two young children in poverty. For her and her two small children, there was not a bed, nor a chair, nor food in the house, the investigator said. When the widow's baby got sick, the guardian still refused to turn over any of her money, though she pleaded for it. Without proper food and medical care, the baby died, the investigator said. The Osage were aware of such schemes, but had no means to stop them. After the widow lost her baby, evidence of the fraud was brought before a county judge only to be ignored. "There is no hope of justice so long as these conditions are permitted to remain," the investigator concluded. The human cry of this woman is a call to America. An Osage speaking to a reporter about the guardian stated, "Your money draws them, and you're absolutely helpless. They have all the law and all the machinery on their side. Tell everybody, when you write your story, that they're scalping our souls out here." 15. The Hidden Face. One day that September, the undercover operative who was pretending to be an insurance salesman stopped at a filling station in Fairfax and struck up a conversation with a woman working there. When the operative told her that he was looking to buy a house in the vicinity, she mentioned that William Hale controlled everything in these parts. She said that she'd purchased her own home from Hale, which was on the edge of his pasture. One night, she recalled, thousands of acres of Hale's land had been set on fire. Nothing was left behind but ashes. Most people didn't know who had started the blaze, but she did. Hale's workers, on his orders, had torched the land for the insurance money, $30,000 in all. White tried to learn more about another suspicious matter, How had Hale become the beneficiary of Henry Roan's $25,000 life insurance policy? After Roan turned up with a bullet in the back of his head in 1923, Hale had the most obvious motive. Yet the sheriff had never investigated Hale, nor had other local lawmen, an oversight that no longer seemed incidental